trash. But what's false is the imagined story that became an Oscar-nominated screenplay. Every time you imagine how much your job sucks, or how you're still stuck in a loveless marriage, or how you'll never get in shape, you are repeating your loops. Over time, these loops become deeply held beliefs, influencing your day-in, day-out decisions that over the long haul determine the direction of your life. Ultimately, your loops become self-fulfilling prophecies. If you think, I'm no good at running, you won't run. Therefore, you'll be no good at running. That's the bad news about imagination. If we don't know any better, it will carry us away. The good news is that imagination, properly wielded, can also be used to come up with powerful new stories. You can choose what to imagine. Our natural inclination is to think in terms of what we do not want. I need to get out of this relationship, or it sucks to drive around in this beat-up car, or I don't want to sit in the cubicle next to the guy who farts. To rebuild our mind and rebuild our lives, we have to be able to picture clearly what it is we want. Pull yourself back from the mind movie for a moment and think about how you could rewrite those negative loops. You could just as easily imagine, I can find a satisfying job, or I can work on this marriage, or I'm slapping on some spandex and going for a jog. In your imagination, you can instantly create and destroy these ideas like variables in code. If you believe in those negative loops, if you think they're the way things have to be, I want to chip away at that belief. I've got my chisel, and I am cracking away at the mortar that holds together the bricks that bind you. Eventually, I hope to open a hole in this wall and let a shaft of brilliant sunlight come streaming in. I want to convince you that imagination is real. In some ways, it is more real than the world around you. And with a little training and practice, you can develop your power of imagination to not only change your life, but to change the world around you. Your world can become anything you can imagine. Welcome to the Matrix. The man wears sunglasses and a trench coat. He sits across from a young computer programmer in a room with walls the sickly color of split pea soup. The Matrix is everywhere, the man intones. It is all around us, even now in this very room. Thunder crackles in the distance. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
Asks Neo, the bewildered computer geek. Morpheus leans in. That you are a slave, he responds. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born into a prison you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. He produces a small silver case, then holds out two pills. One red, one blue. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Neo hesitates, then reaches for the red pill. Morpheus warns him. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth. Nothing more. The scene that follows next in The Matrix is incredibly weird and difficult to explain, so we'll just say Neo experiences firsthand that he has indeed been living in a simulated reality, a mind movie. As this artificial reality disintegrates, Neo comes to understand that The Matrix, this world he lived in, is nothing but computer code. It can be reprogrammed. Neo joins a group of rebels who have learned to hack the Matrix, re-entering the artificial reality they used to call home in order to free other enslaved humans by showing them the truth. And because they now know how the Matrix works, they can bend the physical laws of reality and give themselves superhuman powers, like the ability to dodge bullets while wearing floor-length trench coats. For most people, trench coats are quite constricting. Like Neo, we, too, are in a kind of prison of the mind. Our mental loops keep us trapped in this prison with invisible walls, convinced that our current reality is the only reality. But like the Matrix, we can hack back into our minds, rewriting our mental code. Once again, the key question is, what do you want? Before I got sober, for example, I would feel incredibly awkward in face-to-face conversations, because I imagined that I was no good with people. I would be talking with someone, and all I could think about was how they were perceiving me. Was I standing up straight? Was I funny enough? Did I have a piece of kale in my teeth? It's difficult to be really engaged in a conversation when your mind is obsessing over your every potential flaw. This is why so many of us drink, to get rid of that sense of awkward self-consciousness. What did I want? I wanted to feel comfortable around people. After sobriety, one of my mind hacks was to start telling myself, I'm good with people. Through hundreds and thousands of repetitions of that simple idea, I was slowly able to turn things around so that now I really am pretty good with people. It happens slowly, a gradual metamorphosis, but you can work on those old thoughts of why you suck and reimagine them as thoughts of positivity and self-esteem. Let's take my emotion thought action loop from the previous section and start to imagine what shiny new metal might look like. Emotion, anxiety about a new assignment at work. Thought, I don't know if I can deliver this in a way that will make my boss happy. Action, doubting the results of my work, redoing the project multiple times, unnecessary overtime and stress. New loop, I'm very good at this job. Emotion, depression about my relationship with my partner. Thought, we're not as close as we were before, and we're drifting further apart. Action, getting angry at my partner over minor issues, passive-aggressive behavior, and frequent criticisms. New loop, we are growing closer every day. Emotion, self-criticism over that stupid thing I said. Thought, why did I say that? Why did I say that? Why did I say that? Action, being self-conscious about everything I say to this person in the future. New loop, I'm confident in everything I do and say. Emotion, regret about that decision I made in the past. Thought, I shouldn't have done that. I wish I could do it all over. My life would look so much better. Action, self-doubt and procrastination about making any decisions in the present. New loop, I'm grateful that I am older and wiser and making great decisions because of it. Emotion, worry about my career after graduation. Thought, the job market is terrible. I have no experience. There are lots of other people more qualified than me. Action, reading gossip sites and watching funny llama videos instead of looking for a job. New loop, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. By developing the skill of imagination, you can learn to picture what you want, not just what you don't want. Just as a technology hacker finds a new use for an existing gadget, turning a leaf blower into a homemade hovercraft, you can construct new ways of thinking about yourself and the world. By choosing to think in larger, more positive terms, you begin to rewrite your personal reality in a larger, more positive direction. Your life gets not unimaginably better, but imaginably better. Now imagine that Morpheus is standing beside you, offering you the choice between two pills. Which will you take? Homemade Play-Doh. I liked The Matrix better the first time when it was called The Allegory of the Cave. It was a screenplay written by the ancient Greek dude Plato, and because the original story was a little confusing, I'll simplify it for modern times. In the cave, there are a bunch of prisoners chained to seats inside a movie theater. They're forced to watch the world's most boring movie, just the projector shining white light on the screen. Their heads are locked forward, like in A Clockwork Orange, which is a movie they never see. In fact, they never see any movie, just light and the occasional shadow. This is because the prison warden is also the projectionist, and he paces around in the projection booth, frequently walking in front of the projector as he shouts at them. Sometimes his girlfriend comes over and they argue or have sex, so all the prisoners see is shadows and light, and all they hear is the distant sound of bickering or moaning. After a few years of this, the prisoners begin to think that the shadows are the prison warden, or his girlfriend, or the other people that stop by. But how do the prisoners eat, you might ask? How do they go to the bathroom? Wouldn't they figure it out? Plato's screenplay had a lot of plot holes, I'll admit. That's probably why it was in turnaround for thousands of years. But it gets better. One day, one of the prisoners breaks free. Our protagonist sees the projectionist, and his mind is blown. He walks out the doors of the theater and into the lobby. Popcorn, candy, Starbucks! He walks outside into the mall. His eyes are dazzled by the overhead fluorescent lights. He can't make sense of any of it. It's so utterly different from his light-shadow reality that he struggles to come to grips with this reality behind the reality. Eventually, he goes back into the movie theater and tries to tell the other prisoners what's out there. "There's this crunchy yellow stuff you can eat called popcorn," he raves. "And this hot brown liquid called coffee. You buy it all with money, which is valuable green paper." The prisoners look at each other and begin to whisper. Clearly he's gone insane. Let this be a lesson to all of us. Whatever happens, do not leave your seat. The premise behind Plato's Cave, I don't think he ever wrote Cave 2, The Redemption, was that most of us take physical reality at face value. But underneath, there is another world, a world of ideas. The ideas, in fact, are the true reality. They are, in a sense, more real than what we call reality. Think of how much of your personal reality starts in your imagination. You want to spend a night out with friends, you plan it out in your head first. If you desire to build a company, first you build it in your mind. Before you produce meaningfully, you produce it first mentally. Your mind is the workshop for your life. The British physicist Sir Arthur Stanley Eddington was the Neil deGrasse Tyson of his day, an immensely popular science writer who became a household name during the 1920s and 1930s due to his clear, humorous explanations of difficult scientific topics. He liked to describe the universe not as a purely physical reality, but as something more like a great idea. Quote, "It is difficult for the matter-of-fact physicist to accept the view that the substratum of everything is of mental character. But no one can deny that mind is the first and most direct thing in our experience, and all else is remote inference." Unquote. It is still difficult to accept the view that everything is of mental character. But once you accept that your mind is where your life starts, everything gets so much simpler. To change your life, change your mind. And once you change your mind, you can change your life in any way you can imagine. Thinking of your world as a great idea really is a great idea. The reality distortion field. Quote, illusion is first of all needed to find the powers of which the self is capable. Unquote. Paul Horgan, Pulitzer Prize winning author. In February 1981, Bud Tribble, one of the key software developers on the original Macintosh computer, welcomed one of Apple's new employees, Andy Hertzfeld, by telling him they were scheduled to ship the Macintosh software in just 10 months. 10 months, Hertzfeld remarked. That's impossible. Tribble agreed. The best way to describe the situation is a term from Star Trek, he explained. Steve Jobs has a reality distortion field. It would make sense that a guy named Tribble would use a Star Trek reference. He was referring to a two-part episode entitled The Menagerie, in which the crew finds a planet called Talos, whose inhabitants are able to create virtual realities in the minds of other people. Or as Tribble later put it, creating their own new world through sheer mental force. Tribble went on to explain this reality distortion field to his new employee. In Jobs' presence, reality is malleable. He can convince anyone of practically anything. It wears off when he's not around, but it makes it hard to have realistic schedules. Note that this was a veteran developer making this claim, not some woo-woo weirdo. Hertzfeld thought that Tribble was exaggerating, until he saw it for himself. Hertzfeld later wrote, quote, the reality distortion field was a confounding melange of a charismatic rhetorical style, an indomitable will, and an eagerness to bend any fact to fit the purpose at hand. Amazingly, the reality distortion field seemed to be effective even if you were acutely aware of it, although the effects would fade after Steve departed. We would often discuss potential techniques for grounding it, but after a while, most of us gave up, accepting it as a force of nature. Unquote. Jobs's reality distortion field was a personal refusal to accept limitations that stood in the way of his ideas, to convince himself that any difficulty was surmountable. This field was so strong that he was able to convince others that they too could achieve the impossible. It was an internal reality so powerful it also became an external reality. Whatever you may say about Jobs, he was a master mind hacker. To use Tribble's phrase, Jobs created his own new world through sheer mental force. Now, compare that with our typical approach. When confronted with a new idea, we quickly assess whether it seems feasible for us. I'm terrible at talking to people. We fret to ourselves at a club and sit in the corner. Or, I could invest my money in that stock, but knowing my luck, I'll probably lose it all. We might tell ourselves, I'm a lousy runner. Or, I'm no good at math. We might say, everyone in my family got divorced, so I will too. Or, I come from a long line of engineers, so that's why I don't do well with emotions. Think back to the problem loops you identified in the previous section. Most likely, these are limitations you've placed on yourself, or others, or the world. Limitations that exist largely in your mind. You have within yourself your own reality distortion field. What you consider possible and impossible for yourself are just ideas. They're loops that can be reprogrammed. You can find the boundaries of what you consider possible and consciously widen them. You can achieve the impossible by training your mind to believe otherwise. Thinking anything is possible does not mean it's possible next week or even next year. We need to make a plan for what we can achieve and do the work to make it a reality. We'll cover this in part 3. But an attitude of anything is possible is the foundation from which we should begin. As the great author and naturalist John Muir proclaimed, "The power of imagination makes us infinite." This is so much bigger than just reprogramming your negative thought loops. If you were learning to program and all you did was debug other people's code, you'd lose interest pretty quickly. But being able to build something completely new and amazing is the joy of hacking. And mind hacking is no different. As Mark Zuckerberg said about programming, if you can code, you have the power to sit down and make something, and no one can stop you. Your life, your future, is a wide open vista. Consciously reshape your thoughts, and you can actively reshape the world around you. Once you think about it, anything is possible. The infinite loop. Quote, "Space is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the drugstore, but that's just peanuts to space." Unquote. So begins the famous interplanetary travel guide, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, preparing the adventurous traveler for the nearly unlimited variety of experiences available while hitchhiking around space. From the breathtaking beaches of Babal, where time flows backwards so it is possible to leave your 2-week vacation earlier than you arrived, to the nightclub at the beginning of the universe, where you can watch the Big Bang unfold beneath a pulsing disco beat, anything is possible in space. Similarly, your mind is a vast, unexplored landscape. We might even say infinite, since there is no limit to what can be imagined. It is a universe of possibilities, a limitless horizon of potential. Our minds have unlimited imagining power. This is not just some phrase to put on an inspirational poster underneath a photo of a man hanging onto the talons of an eagle in flight. It's a simple and obvious fact. Your mind is as big as you can imagine it to be. Dr. Ellen Langer, the longest-running professor of psychology at Harvard, came up with an ingenious experiment to test the effects of imagination on aging. She first created an environment straight out of the 1950s, down to the smallest details. A black-and-white TV playing Ed Sullivan clips, an old-fashioned radio playing Perry Como. Then she recruited 8 men in their 70s to live in this environment for 5 days. When they entered this virtual reality, Langer asked these seniors not just to reminisce about their younger years, but to make a psychological attempt to be the person they were in 1959. In other words, to imagine they were young again. "We have good reason to believe that if you are successful at this," she told them, "you will feel as you did in 1959. Throughout the experiment, as the senior citizens talked about current events, events of the 1950s, they were encouraged to talk about them in the present tense. There were no mirrors, no current photographs, nothing that would spoil the illusion of being young again. The results were astounding. At the end of their stay, the elderly subjects were tested on a number of age-related factors, from memory to dexterity, and were shown to significantly improve versus a control group. A panel of independent judges said they sat up straighter and looked younger. Although it seems impossible, even their sight got better. As the New York Times Magazine reported, they had put their minds in an earlier time, and their bodies went along for the ride. Our minds are as large as we imagine them to be. We instinctively know this when we refer to a small-minded person as someone who is petty or bigoted, and an exceptionally large mind to talk about someone like Stephen Hawking. Indeed, Hawking is a terrific example of someone who did not allow his physical handicap to limit his greatness. How many of us, if confined to a wheelchair with nothing but a few eye movements to communicate, would approach the world-changing creative output of Hawking? I've been lucky enough to work with a number of entrepreneurial advisors. What the best advisors do is continually expand your sense of what's possible. They take your initial number, then add a zero. If you want to grow a $20 million business, they encourage you to think about a $200 million business. I found this a useful concept as we've grown Media Shower, our content marketing company. Keep adding a zero. Always think about the next level of scale. From 100 to 1,000 customers, from 1,000 to 10,000 customers, from 10,000 to 100,000 customers, and so on. After I got sober and began identifying my problem loops, I started to think about how I was going to reprogram those loops. As I realized my reprogramming could become as big as I imagined, it became an intellectual challenge for me to think up the biggest loops I could. While I suppose an infinite loop would technically be the largest, I found the idea of an exponentially increasing loop to be more exciting. Now, each night before I go to sleep, I reprogram my mind with this loop. My ability to bring amazing things into this world is exponentially increasing. What will this simple thought bring over a lifetime of repeating it? I intend to find out. You can believe that your mind creates your internal reality, and to a large degree, your external reality as well. Using imagination, you can learn to not only be happier and think more positively, but to create bigger and better things for yourself and the world, to create your own reality distortion field. Thinking big, however, is easier said than done. Developing big plans requires programming your best possible future, a pleasurable technique of mind hacking that you'll learn next. 2.2, your best possible future. Quote, if you can't conceive of things that don't exist, you can't create anything new. If you can't dream up worlds that might be, then you are limited to the worlds other people describe. Unquote. Robert S. Root Bernstein and Michelle M. Root Bernstein, Sparks of Genius. What do you want? Perhaps you have relatively modest dreams, like graduating with honors, or finding your soulmate, or becoming a millionaire. Maybe your ambitions are greater, like eradicating a major disease, or building a world-changing charity, or running a nation. Or perhaps we're really thinking big together, inventing a new branch of science, or colonizing other planets, or improving the mental state of the human race. It's easy to figure out what you don't want. They're the things you're always complaining about to yourself and everyone else. But do you know what you want? Have you written it down? If you get the dreaded job interview question, where do you see yourself in 20 years? Will you have a thoughtful answer, or will you draw a blank? In a fascinating study by psychologist Laura King, college students were asked to write for 20 minutes a day about their best possible future self. She challenged them to stretch their imaginations to envision the biggest, best-case scenario for their lives. After just a few days, the test subjects who spent the time imagining a positive future were significantly happier and more positive than a control group. Another longer-term study by King showed that writing positively made them healthier as well, with fewer visits to doctors. Here's a mini version of King's experiment. Close your eyes and imagine your life in 10 years with your best possible outcome. Try to picture your best possible future in vivid detail. Where will you live? What will you do for work? For fun? Will you have a partner? What kinds of friends will you have? How much money will you have? What will your mind look like? Go on, close your eyes and see what you find. I'll wait. Most people have a vague idea of what they want out of life, but they've never taken the time to imagine it. If you ask them point blank, they might give you a vague answer like more money or happiness or a pony. Instead of captaining their own ship, most people float wherever the waves take them. How is it that something as important as our future, the thing that should matter above all else, gets so little attention? I believe the answer is simple. Imagination is difficult. When I try to imagine the exercise, it's like seeing a series of images flashing through my mind, but dark and hazy, like a grainy video. If I feed more questions into the stream, I get more pictures. For example, in my best possible future, how do I want to feel? Who are my celebrity friends? How many zebras do I own? Have I learned to levitate? Each one of these brings a series of accompanying images, slippery and fluid. It's hard to hold on to any of them as they're instantly replaced with something else. Worse, my mind keeps wanting to change the subject, to follow some other train of thought, the disobedient dog again. So keeping it focused on the object of my imagination, to persist without giving up, is quite difficult. I challenge you to spend the next 5 minutes really picturing what you want your life to look like in 10 years. If you can't invest 5 minutes thinking about what you want to become, you have to seriously question your priorities. These 5 minutes could mean the difference between a life of confusion and sorrow and a life of happiness and fulfillment. What could be more important than that? In fact, unless you live your life under the assumption that riches, relationships, and rock stars are going to suddenly fall from the sky, it's just an obvious fact that you're going to need to figure out what you want from life. And the way you figure that out is in your mind. You imagine it. Pause this program for 5 minutes and imagine. I'm patient. Does your experience agree with mine? Did you find it incredibly challenging to spend 5 minutes in imagination? It's odd that something as important as your personal future, arguably the most important thing in your life, would be so difficult to focus on. But that's the way it is with imagination. Imagination is hard mental work. To really imagine well, in my experience, is as difficult as actual physical work. Note, I am not talking about following the mind movie or being caught in a daydream. I'm talking about actively imagining, focusing your mind on creating a clear mental picture. It feels more like work. It feels like moving things around with your mind, creating mental schemas or blueprints or plans. In mind hacking, we learn to identify the feel of imagining. And not to shy away from it, but to actively engage in it with persistence and playfulness. It should feel like manipulating mental objects. Real manual work, moving things around. Imagine digging or sculpting with your mind. Only through exercising this active visualizing component, like a muscle, can we build up its power and strength. One click, one idea. In 1997, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos was having lunch with Amazon's first employee, Shel Kaplan, and his programmer, Perry Hartman. Websites at the time were still clunky, and Bezos was obsessed then, as he is now, with making it as easy as possible for customers to order products from Amazon.com. He issued them a crazy challenge. invent a way for customers to order from Amazon with a single click. The idea of one-click ordering is now so natural that we barely notice it. Back then, the idea was nuts. This was a time when the idea of ordering products from a website still made many people nervous. Will my credit card be stolen? How can I see the products first? What if I need to return it? Ordering online seemed risky and weird, much less ordering with one click. The development team worked like mad to develop the single-click ordering feature. When they showed the first prototype of one click to Bezos, it ended up requiring 12 clicks. They explained to Bezos there were certain steps you simply couldn't eliminate. A customer had to give Amazon a mailing address, for example, and a credit card number. Customers needed a confirmation screen so they wouldn't place an order by accident. One click, Bezos replied. After many more hours of deliberation, the team came back to Bezos with an improved prototype. This one allowed customers to save their mailing address and credit card information in their accounts, another crazy idea for the time, then make a purchase with one click. But they still needed one more click to confirm that the customer wanted to make the purchase. It was still just one problem. Their one-click ordering system required two clicks. One click, Bezos demanded. Finally, the team hit upon the solution. Let customers place the order with one click, and if they placed it by accident, let them easily cancel the purchase. It seems obvious in retrospect, but good ideas always do. As soon as Amazon showed it was possible, other online retailers rushed to copy the idea. The idea that had recently seemed impossible now seemed indispensable to online success. And in fact, it was. Thanks to the power of that idea and many others like it, Amazon grew to dominate the online retail industry. And it all started in Bezos's frighteningly large imagination. We have a strange attitude toward imagination. When we see it in geniuses like Jeff Bezos, we call it vision. When we see it in children, we call it cute. When we see it in ourselves, we often call it a dumb idea or a crazy thought. In reality, however, it's the same skill, the skill of developing a clear mental picture. Bezos used nothing but his imagination to transform reality. What did he actually do? His developers did all the work. Trust me that Bezos was not mocking up wireframes and writing functions. All he did was create a clear mental picture in his mind of what he wanted, then ride the development team until they got it done. Let's picture the world of ideas, the world of imagination, as being something like the working memory of a computer. This is a state where the computer is holding a great deal of data in its head. It hasn't been written to a hard drive or saved to the cloud. If you pull the plug, you lose it all. It's a kind of mental workspace. Our minds provide that same mental workspace, a place where we can dream, develop, and refine the ideas that will eventually shape our physical world. Imagination is not just a toy for children. It's the blueprint for reality. And in fact, we use imagination every day to decide where to meet our friends for dinner or how to tackle a difficult algorithm. It happens up here before it happens out there. How is it that we do not teach this in schools? There are no high school imagination teams. No standardized tests for imagining, no extra credit given for drawing a picture of an insane motorized animal on your biology homework. You do not get an A in history class for writing a short story where Eleanor Roosevelt fights Nazis by shooting lasers from her nipples. Perhaps this is why we do not value imagination for its fundamental importance as a mental workspace where everything begins. Imagination has reality. It is real in the same way that a blueprint is real to the finished building. It is real in the same way that a schema is real to the database. It is real in the same way that an idea jotted down on a whiteboard is real to the business itself. Put another way, imagination is a representation that precedes the thing itself. And you, the you that is separate from your mind, are able to summon it at will. It is an awesome power. Begin call out. Imagination, then realization. End call out. In 1962, legendary science fiction writer and geek hero Arthur C. Clarke wrote an essay entitled Hazards of Prophecy, The Failure of Imagination. In that essay, he famously declared that, quote, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, unquote. As an example, if we took a human from the Dark Ages and showed him a modern computer or microwave oven, he would be convinced they were powered by sorcery and witchcraft. Looked at from Clark's perspective, our imagination is both an incredibly advanced technology and indistinguishable from magic. The fact that you can conjure up entire worlds in your mind, that you can visualize the future course of reality, really is like a kind of magic. However, we must be careful to avoid falling into magical thinking. I am regularly amazed at how many well-educated people suffer from one of the two following superstitions. Magical negative thinking, the belief that if we think or say something terrible, it will instantly come to pass. You can spot this thinking through the use of phrases like God forbid, or knock on wood, or putting a little too much faith in fortune cookies. Certainly, we are constantly imagining things that do not come to pass. We do not need to be afraid of our own dark thoughts. Magical positive thinking. The belief that all we need to do is think positive thoughts, then sit back and relax as life manifests them for us. When I talk about imagination being like a kind of magic, I'm not saying that imagination will make things magically appear. That requires hard work and the techniques you'll learn in part 3. But consistently applied and mixed with work, it will make things more likely to appear, just as one click eventually appeared for Jeff Bezos. It is a simple and obvious fact that nothing of value can be achieved until you first see it in your mind. So tell me, when you unlock that secret treasure chest in your mind, what do you see? Feel, do, have, give, and be. Now that you're warmed up, we'll play 5 easy imagination games. The goal is to simply write down one result for each of the following mind games. Number 1, the mood chip. A group of biotech hardware entrepreneurs have developed a revolutionary new mood chip that can be surgically implanted into your brain. Originally developed to treat Alzheimer's, they found that it can treat a wide array of symptoms, from depression to ADD. The chip can be programmed to give you a feeling boost in any emotional direction you like. In fact, different versions of the chip are marketed with names like happy, calm, focused, inquisitive, ambitious, compassionate, decisive, empowered, and positive. Think of these in relation to the problem loops you identified earlier. You have the funds to buy exactly one mood chip. Close your eyes and imagine, what is the one word that describes how you would like to feel? Number 2, the $50 million inheritance. It's a story straight out of a movie. A great-great-great aunt whom you've never met passes away, leaving behind a small fortune. Her will stipulates that her estate must stay within the family. Because she was quite old herself, all her relatives are now deceased, except for you. She lived very frugally, so other than selling her mobile home and 12 cases of Diet Pepsi, the rest of her $50 million fortune is yours, right now, in cash. You now have the freedom to do anything you want in life, from building your own monster truck to climbing K2. Close your eyes and imagine, what is the one thing you've always wanted to do? Number 3. The genie in the lamp. Some people buy scratch tickets, you buy antique lamps. You travel the world, shopping in obscure Middle Eastern bazaars, in hopes that you will finally find the enchanted lamp that contains a wondrous genie. One day you return to your hotel, shopping bags full of lamps, and find that you've hit the jackpot. Not one, but two lamps contain a genie, each granting you one wish. Knowing the genii are crafty and will do anything to trick you out of your wish, you pull a meta wish and wish the first genie to force the second genie to honor his word. Now you have one wish left. Close your eyes and imagine. What is the one thing you would like to have? Number 4. Your evolution contribution. The legendary hedge fund manager Ray Dalio, in his excellent book Principles, talks of evolution from a very practical viewpoint. He describes evolution as the desire to get better, stating, quote, "Society rewards those who give it what it wants," unquote. In other words, the way to get rich or be successful in worldly terms is not to chase money or success, but to contribute something genuinely useful to the world. This is ideally something you're passionate about, whether raising great children, writing great music, or developing a great new compression algorithm. Close your eyes and imagine, what is the one thing you would like to contribute to the world? Number 5. The funeral speech. One day, both you and I will be dead. Sorry to break the news. During our funerals, I don't know how we both have funerals on the same day, I'm just trying to make you feel better about being dead. Our loved ones will stand up and say a few words about our lives, nicely condensed into a 10-minute speech, because a lot of people will be anxious to just get to the sandwich trays at the reception. When they give your eulogy, what is it you want them to say about you? In other words, who do you want to be? Close your eyes and imagine, what is the one adjective that describes who you would like to be? Begin mind game. The 5 words. Complete the 5 imagination games in this section. Write down 1 word for each. It's better to get it done than get it perfect. You can always add more later. Write down the 5 words on your practice sheet. End mind game. 2.3. Creating positive thought loops. Benjamin Franklin was a geek. Throughout his life, Walter Isaacson notes in his excellent biography, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life, he loved immersing himself in minutiae and trivia in a manner so obsessive that today it might be described as geeky. He points to Franklin's methodical research, unbounded curiosity, and constant inventiveness. Note our analyze, imagine, and reprogram framework again. On topics as diverse as ballooning, education, electricity, eyeglasses, fire safety, heating technology, music, politics, and weather. Franklin was also a master mind hacker. Hundreds of years before people were using fitness tracking devices, he came up with a self-improvement experiment that let him track his mind-hacking progress in a measurable, scientific way. As described in his autobiography, Franklin gave his experiment the lofty title of the Moral Perfection Project. He began by laying out a set of 13 virtues that he wished to develop in himself. 1. Temperance, moderating eating and drinking. 2. Silence, speaking only when it benefits others or yourself. 3. Order, letting everything have its place. 4. Resolution, resolving to do what you should, doing without fail what you resolve. 5. Frugality, being careful with money and resources, wasting nothing. 6. Industry, working hard but efficiently. 7. Sincerity, meaning what you say, saying what you mean. 8. Justice, wronging no one, either by what you do or don't do. 9. Moderation, avoiding extremes and letting go of grudges. 10. Cleanliness, keeping your body, clothes, home, and workspace clean. 11. Tranquility, calmly accepting small misfortunes that are common and unavoidable. 12. Chastity, moderating sexual activity. 13. Humility, imitating Jesus and Socrates. These virtues became Franklin's positive thought loops. His method of reprogramming his mind with these values was both simple and ingenious. In a diary, he made a simple grid with columns representing each day of the week and rows representing each of the 13 virtues. Reasoning that it would be easier to tackle one virtue at a time, he listed them in order of importance, so that one habit built upon the next. Temperance came first because you couldn't make progress on the other virtues if you were drunk all the time. Once you had temperance under control, it would be easier to tackle silence. Once silence was conquered, order would follow, and so on. Each day, Franklin reviewed his progress across all 13 virtues, marking with a black spot any day in which he did not live up to his ideal. But each week he also had a target virtue, or thought loop, that he would strive to keep clear for the entire week. Thus, in the first week, his thought loop would be focused on temperance. Having strengthened that virtue, he would focus on silence in the second week, and so on. Since there are 52 weeks in a year, Franklin was able to go through the list of 13 virtues precisely 4 times in a year, a mathematical system any geek can appreciate. Perhaps Franklin expected to be done with it in a year, but he ended up using the system for most of his life. I was surprised to find myself so much fuller of faults than I had imagined, Franklin recalled later. But I had the satisfaction of seeing them diminish. Indeed, Franklin's life is powerful testimony that these positive thought loops worked. Although he was only human, he died an accomplished and respected man who certainly left the world a better place. Not only did he invent the lightning rod, bifocals, odometer, urinary catheter, and swim fins, he also invented the self-help book. Positive versus negative. Multiple studies show that we respond better to positive than negative feedback. One of my favorite examples is the speed camera lottery, an experiment run in Stockholm, Sweden. In many cities, speed cameras are used to automatically issue tickets when a motorist is caught driving over the speed limit. Kevin Richardson, a gaming producer for Nickelodeon, had an idea to flip the model on its head. In his version of the speed camera, everyone who was caught driving under the speed limit would be entered into a lottery to win a portion of the speeding fines. In other words, drive over and you could get a ticket, drive under and you could win it. Richardson's idea was tested out on a street in Stockholm. The results were fascinating. As the New York Times reported, average speed before the installation of the speed camera lottery sign on a multi-lane street was 32 kilometers an hour. That figure dropped to 25 kilometers an hour during a 3-day test, despite the device's inability to issue financial penalties. Thinking of all the interesting ways we can penalize a few bad or distracted apples, Richardson was quoted, is a misdistribution of energy and attention. While this is true for distracted drivers, it's also true for our distracted minds. Once we become aware of our negative thought loops, we may start berating or penalizing ourselves for them. Just as with math, adding two negatives does not bring you to positive. Still, negative feedback feels more natural. When your child is climbing on top of the glass coffee table with a hammer, the most natural thing in the world is to scream, "No!" My wife, who is an excellent parent of our two kids, taught me early on to resist the natural urge to say no, and to instead reframe it in the positive. What is it that you want your kids to do? Hammer in the garage, or toy hammer only, or shop eBay for a new coffee table are more constructive alternatives, because then the kids know what is acceptable. Your mind is like a child. You need to condition it by continually reinforcing what you want it to do, not what you don't want it to do. If you think, "I don't want to feel anxious anymore," or "I don't want to fail at work," or "I don't want my life to look like this," you're just defining the absence of the negative loop. It doesn't work to just cut out the problem code. You have to rewrite it. It's more work to define what you want. It's harder to tell kids what they should be doing than to shout no. It's more difficult to explain to your partner or your family or your friends what you need than what's annoying you. But if you don't take the time to do it, if you can't articulate it to yourself and someone else, then you're expecting the world to figure it out for you and serve it up like a robotic butler. The story of Mel. One of the classic pieces of hacker literature is a text document called The Story of Mel. Originally circulated on the Usenet newsgroup net.jokes, the story recounts the godlike programming abilities of a developer named Mel. Written in irreverent poetry prose, the story has the cadence and feel of a piece of holy scripture. Little is known about Mel, but subsequent generations of geeks have theorized he was an actual person, Mel K, who wrote the software for the 1959 Royal McBee LGP30 computer. Mel had created a blackjack game for the LGP30, one of the first of its kind. The Royal McBee sales reps would take the LGP30 to trade shows where they would let prospective customers play the blackjack game. It's hard to remember there was a day when most people had never played a computer game, and the experience was so thrilling that it usually sold the LGP30 on the spot, even though it was a business computer. There was only one problem. Mel's blackjack game was too good. Sometimes the prospective customers lost, if you can imagine that. Concerned they were losing out on valuable sales opportunities, the Royal McBee sales reps approached Mel and told him the game was too fair. They asked if he could modify the blackjack game so they could secretly flip a switch on the LGP30 when they wanted to let prospective customers win. Mel was morally opposed to this change. His code was statistically perfect, an elegant representation of real-world blackjack odds. How dare they ask him to insert an error into his perfect simulation? After getting some heat from above, Mel reluctantly complied. When he tested the cheat switch, however, he found the computer cheated in the opposite direction, so the computer always won. He was delighted with this hack, of course, and eventually left